is Moss versus Spartanburg County School District 7. And Mr. Daly, whenever you're ready, we'll hear from you.
All right.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry to say I have a head cold that feels like it's terminal. I know it's not terminal, but it just feels that way. So I may have to stop and make adjustments.
Well, if it's actually proves to be terminal, we'll take appropriate action.
Good. He knows how to call 911.
First might be waiving our normal greeting of council after the closing.
I thought about that. No offense. This case arises from the District Court of South Carolina, and it presents the question of whether the Establishment Clause prevents a school board from delegating to a religious institution its authority to give a public school academic credit. According to the Lemon case, these cases fall into two general types. By far, the most prevalent case is one where the question is whether the government has done something to advance religion.
Can I go back to your statement of the issue? I didn't understand that the school delegated whether to accept credit. I thought the school said we will base that on the secular standards for credit, just as if a religious school student transferred to a state school, they would look at his credits and decide which to accept. But I don't think there was an actual delegation, was there? I mean, obviously the religious school has to decide whether to give him credit, and the grades, there was one or two that even flunked their courses and surely wouldn't get credit based on the religious school. But it seems to me the issue is whether the high school establishes religion by allowing a student to go to a religious school, take a course, and give the student credit for that course with the precondition, of course, that he pass the course and it passes the secular test. But they did talk about applying secular tests for that, didn't they?
The policy says the school district will accept the grade. Now, granted, the religious organization gives the grade, but that grade is not a public school grade until it comes back to the public school and the public school accepts it.
What if the student attended for 2 years of high school a very rigorous rabbinical school? Learned theology and philosophy and history in a totally religious context. And it was accredited, and its grades, we can even make the hypothetical more difficult. The grades are very difficult in that school. It's a rigorous school. And a student transfers from that school to high school. Would the school be establishing religion and recognizing those grades?
Under this policy, yes, because they've made an absolute ab initio decision that you send the grade and we're going to accept it. This is a case about the fundamental allocation of governmental power between the church and the state. It's not, at least in the aspect I want to start with, it's not a question of weighing the facts and circumstances. That policy says we will accept the grade. And there is another sentence in that policy, if I can find it here, that says...
Well, the statute seems to belie what you're saying. The statute says that the grades must be evaluated on the basis of purely secular criteria that are substantially the same criteria used to evaluate similar classes at established private high schools for purposes of determining whether the student transferring to the public high school from private school will be awarded credit. These purely secular criteria included but not limited to, and then the number of hours, the review course syllabus, the materials, methods of assessment in the courses, and whether the course was taught by a certified teacher. Now, that is a lot different from what you just told us.
Pardon?
That's a lot different from what you just told us.
It is, and it's a different law, and it's not the one we challenged. That's the state statute.
Well, sure.
And it's quite...
That's what they're operating under, isn't it?
No, they're operating under a local policy, which is Addendum 1.
I understand, but isn't that enacted pursuant to the state law?
Nobody ever said so. No, they enacted a policy, and their policy is quite different from the state law. The state law policy is permissive. You may accept a grade, and the policy is not optional. It says, we will accept grades, and the testimony makes it very clear at page 273 of the record, the 30B6 witness says, everything transfers. You don't have any discretion about it. Now, there is a second sentence in the policy which says that they will evaluate on the basis of secular criteria, which is a part of what the state statute says, but...
It's implementation of the state statute. State statute says it'll evaluate on secular basis, and then it spells out what that means.
Well, this policy says they will evaluate based on secular criteria and does not spell out what that means. But in fact, they don't do that. In page 253 of the record, the 30B6 witness, I was talking to him about sentence two, and he says that evaluation would come from the private school that the grades are run through. And that's a religious school, which in fact does review this religious course below it, whose grades it reports, and it reviews them for the excellence of their instruction, as you say, Judge Niemeyer. It also reviews them for religious content. They're an interdenominational school. It says that they will review for whether you have created a proper interdenominational course.
You started out in your issue focusing on the academic credit. And I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, the reason you're doing that is because the Zurich case, which is the Supreme Court, dealt with time release, and in this court dealt with it in the Smith case. And it seems the only differentiating thing in this case is the academic credit. Is that the focus?
I think I'd agree with it. If they weren't for academic credit, I wouldn't be here. Zorak would cover this case, and Smith would cover this case if it weren't for academic credit. And the point about academic credit is that it presents this highly unusual Establishment Clause entanglement action under Larkin against Grendel's Den, because it's just not a question of being sympathetic to them or doing something for them here and there. What they've done is given governmental power to the religious school. It's really an issue that transcends the Establishment Clause. We don't want to give governmental power to any private entity unchecked, but that is what they have done here.
But now, so is, and I think I want to at least follow up on Judge Niemeyer's question on in terms of the academic credit. If it was a private school, if Oakwood, is Oakwood Prep or whatever, right, had just transferred credits, and one of those courses happened to be on religion, didn't come from this Bible school, would there be a problem here with that? I mean, given the transfer from a private accredited school, that of which that's just part of the instruction.
That's what the defendant wants to make the case into. It wants to make the case into a question of the national transfer of credits from private schools, including religious schools. And the problem with making that case is that there's no record on it. Absolutely no record of anything other than what this defendant does with the Oak grade from SC Best. So, you know, as my Aunt Fanny would say, you're just barring trouble to go after that case.
So if you're looking, if we analyze this under the lemon, the purpose seems to be kind of something you could maybe get around, but you are saying the excessive entanglement and the endorsement prongs are ones that are offended here?
I'm saying that the third, both the effect prong, which I'll get to in a while, and the entanglement prong under Lemon are offended, and particularly the entanglement prong because there's this Larkin case, which fits this case like a hand in a glove. And it says if the government delegates a governmental power, a discretionary important governmental power to a church, that offends the Constitution. And that's precisely what they've done here. The only question...
That's what you need to connect, is how did they delegate it to a church?
Because in the Larkin case, they had a bar up in Cambridge that wanted to have a liquor license. And they had a law which says, well, the Greek Orthodox Church is within 500 feet of your back property line, so they can veto your liquor license. So they sent down to the Greek Orthodox Church and said, do you veto the liquor license? And the Greek Orthodox Church makes its decision and sends it back to the zoning board, and the zoning board enforces it. That's precisely what happens here. They say, we'll send our students, and you give them a grade. And at that point, it's a religious grade. But when it comes back, they accept the decision and make it a public school grade.
That's a big difference. In Larkin, you have an ecclesiastical entity making decisions over a person who has no interest in being involved in a religious activity at all or being under their auspices. These students voluntarily go to this class.
Larkin did, pardon me, I interrupted.
Is that correct? Larkin, we're talking about anyone who wants a liquor license had to pass through that gateway. Here you're talking about students who wanted to be in those classes. That's quite different.
That has nothing to do, with all due respect, to the nature of the power. What Larkin talked about was you cannot delegate an important discretionary power. And it didn't say we don't care whether the recipients of the power doing it voluntary or not. That was never mentioned in the Larkin case.
In this case, suppose the religious, the people who conduct the classes believe quite strongly that this is appropriate academically. But if the private accredited school says no, what recourse would the religious institution have? And under the facts of this case, what would be their recourse if they said the academic accrediting private school says, no, I'm not certifying any of that for credit. What would be the recourse?
Well, I would think that in that particular case that since the way they've set it up, it's not in the policy. I'll get to that in a minute. But the way they've set it up is you have the SC Best down here, the private religious organization, which actually gives the grade. But then it has to be passed through.
I know that. That's why I gave you the question. But what's the answer to my question?
Well, I suppose if the second level Oak Brook School says, oh, no, we don't like this, we're not going to pass it on, then it wouldn't get passed on.
So it has no recourse, right?
No recourse for what?
For having those credits to be accepted by the school, the public school.
The students would not be the beneficiaries of the power at that point because the person who passed the credits along wouldn't have agreed to pass them along. But the issue is not who's the beneficiary of the
power. The issue is who has, it can't be delegation when, because you're saying that they're delegating this to a religious organization and you just conceded that they would have no recourse if the intervening or intermediary said, no, we're not going to accept them. So they couldn't have complete delegation of that authority.
Well, they have delegated an important power, whether the delegee wants to exercise it or not.
Well, the delegation was to the academic private accredited private institution, as they do in the. You just conceded at the outset when Judge Niemeyer asked you the question that if this was implementing the state law statute, it would be fine. Is that correct?
No, I didn't. I conceded that the state statute's not involved here.
They cite it in the policy.
Right.
It's right here cited, and I'm looking at the policy.
Well, what they say is quite different from.
They say two things. They say, and I respectfully suggest the sentence you quoted, you didn't read the whole sentence. They said they will accept no more than two elective credits.
Right.
That's the will. And then he said, the district will evaluate classes on the basis of purely secular criteria prior to accepting credit. And then they cite in their footnote, the legal references, the two state acts.
Right, but what they say is the district.
The secular criteria stated in the state act.
Right. What they say in their policy is the district will accept mandatorily.
No, it does not. It says it will accept no more.
Well, accept no more than two. That That's means it will accept two.
It's, no, it says it won't accept any more than two. And then it goes, the next sentence tells what it'll do. It'll evaluate. I mean, we're talking about simple, straightforward English. No more is a lot different than accepting.
Right.
If you say the district will accept no more than two, that means the district will accept two.
No, I mean, they could accept up to that. That's plain English.
No, the state statute says they may accept, and this says they could accept.
Okay.
Or may.
All right, thank you.
We'll
hear you on rebuttal. You do have more time. Ms. Windham?
May it please the court, I want to begin by addressing a couple of points that were raised in the plaintiff's argument. First is this idea that the school district's policy is somehow worse than the state law. That's incorrect. The school district's policy is actually stronger than the state law. What the school district has done here is avoid entanglement
you mean
problems.
You said stronger. Did you mean more restrictive?
It is more restrictive, and I would say stronger in the establishment clause.
From the religious institution, they are distancing themselves by a bunch of criteria.
Exactly, that's right. Rather than going through the process which the state law permits and which the 10th Circuit and Lanner v. Wimmer permitted of evaluating the course based upon neutral secular criteria, what the school district has chosen to do is to require that the grades come through an intermediary, an accredited private school. Now, the school district's policy when it is dealing with grades from an accredited private school is that it receives the transcript and it enters those grades and those credits into the record. If those are core courses, then it checks to see if they're matching up with core courses at the public school. If those are elective courses, then it simply accepts the elective credit as a transfer credit, no questions asked. Even if it's a course the public school doesn't offer, even if it's a course the public school could not offer, it still takes those credits. That is true of all the classes and credits that transfer in from Oak Brook Preparatory. And so what they're doing here with the release time class is simply treating it the same way that they treat all other kinds of private school transfers. A second point that I wanted to address is that the school district the policy that was passed was, of course, motivated by the state law. It was based upon a policy, a model policy written by the South Carolina School Board Association. The release time credit provider had originally proposed a different policy, but the school district chose to go with a policy modeled upon a model policy from the School Board Association, and that's how we arrived at the policy we have. It is, in fact, a stronger.
The School Board Association's policy, was that an effort to implement the state law?
I believe that's correct. And so what we have here is an implementation of state law.
Do you know where the association policy is by any chance? Is it in here?
I'm not certain if we have that included in the record. I'd be happy to advise the court of that by letter if the exact. I think the important point to emphasize is that what the school district has done here is actually added a safeguard over and above the safeguards that were already present in the state law. The plaintiffs have already said they're not challenging the state law, at least on its face, that they are not here to try and invalidate that. They're only challenging the implementation, but the implementation here is actually on stronger constitutional footing than the original state statute.
How do you evaluate a completely religious course in a purely secular basis? I mean, it seems like an oxymoron. I mean, one's clearly not secular, the other is, and how do you evaluate whether or not the instruction is purely on a purely secular basis?
Well, this is a question that the 10th Circuit dealt with in Lanner, and what it said there was there are different criteria you could look at. You could look at the amount of instructional time. You could look at the qualifications of the teachers. You could look at the metrics of measurement that were used. Those kinds of criteria are mentioned in the preamble to the state statute. And also, if you look at the South Carolina Attorney General's opinion, which is also in volume 2 of the appendix, you will see that those are exactly the kinds of secular criteria that they mention as being appropriate for a school district to look at to evaluate this course.
So it almost seems like if we do that, then this court, if we are then trying to determine did they follow this stated purpose of purely secular basis, to then look at the underlying course to see what happened, is that what we do? I mean, almost seems like that's an accreditation thing. That's a whole different issue to me. I'm confused on that in terms of trying to understand. And I know the language is there, and it just makes it nice and pretty, but saying it doesn't make it so to me. So I got to figure out, what is it? How do you do it? I mean, I understand what the 10th Circuit says, but how do you do it? And when it comes on review, what do we review? Do we simply just review, well, they said it, and the statute says it, purely secular basis, or do we look at the course and then go into the instruction and determine whether or not they had certain teachings or did it meet? I mean, how do we do that?
I believe what the court would do, or what the state would do, would be to look at criteria that did not get into the actual religious doctrines being taught. So as I said, things like what are the qualifications of the teacher, what's the amount of instructional time, these other secular criteria that don't get into the religious content of the program. The state could look at that, then the court could look at what the state had done if that case were to come up, and say, just as the 10th Circuit did in Lanner, are you actually evaluating the religiosity of the program to see if it's too religious, or are you just looking at how many hours did the student spend in class,
the secular basis would then look at basically the procedural things that deal with teachers and how is it not the substance of the course?
You could call it procedural. And I would emphasize that this is a course that's being offered for elective credit rather than
That's what I'm getting at, but I'm not trying to cut you off, but I want to try to understand that. Are we to look at the substance of the course at all in determining whether it is a purely secular basis? Because I don't see how in the world you can do that. Or is this just in terms of how it's done? Is it done like other instructions? Religious instruction is... I guess it's just because it's under the Establishment Clause, you got to have something separate out there. But I don't know if you'd do that. Seems like to me they could accept basket weaving as a credit. And I'm not sure you would go into whether or not the weaving itself is substantively good or meets a secular purpose. You would go into who the teachers are and that sort of thing. So is there some limit in terms of where our analysis goes?
I think the analysis would end when a government body is getting involved with analyzing the religious content of the course, rather than looking at how the course was taught, how the students' progress was measured, and other criteria like that. And so that's where the inquiry would stop. And as I said, this is an elective course. You can get elective credit at Spartanburg High School for things including participating in color guard, being in student council, taking driver's education. And so these kinds of courses are not subject to the same kind of searching review that you might have if you were evaluating, say, a math or history course where you have required content that they have to master for graduation.
It just seems to me as though the basis would be is that you cannot promote non-religion either. You can't promote religion, but you can't promote non-religion in terms of not getting into the substantive aspect of it.
I'm not sure I fully understand the question.
In terms of getting into the question of what the course actually teaches and what is, whether or not it's indoctrinating the students and doing things of that nature, is that our focus, or the focus, as you say, is on the quality of teacher? Does it meet the standards for the number of hours it's being taught? All those things that make up a course. And then if we are there, we're not getting into the business of the religious and whether or not it promotes or not promote religion. It's really how it's done to meet the accreditation standards.
I believe, if I'm understanding you, If I'm understanding you correctly, then that's right. You would simply look at the secular criteria, you would look at how the course is taught, and you would not get into these questions of whether this was an evangelical course, an indoctrinating course. That's at the point where you would run into entanglement problems if you're trying to assess whether or not this course is somehow too religious to satisfy the state law. But I want to emphasize that these are all hypotheticals, because what the school district has done here is avoided even getting into that inquiry by simply deciding to treat religious release time instruction the same way as it would other elective credit transfers that come through private schools, and that is they don't have to get into evaluating the specific content of the course because they rely on the accreditation agencies to certify the courses. They rely on the accredited private schools to certify the academic rigor of their courses. They simply act as pass-throughs, taking that information and then transferring it on to the student's transcript.
You comfortable with the standing issue in this case, that we can just move on into this issue without really dealing with the standing of it?
No, we don't believe the plaintiffs have standing here. They have not had any direct contact with the program. They have not suffered any sort of cognizable injury. What they have is simply knowledge of a policy that offends them.
To group them is a little difficult. It sounds to me like you make a very persuasive argument with respect to Tillett, Morris, the student Morris, was in a different situation, right, than Tillett. Tillett didn't even know what was going on. As a matter of fact, Tillett was told by her mother, which was discovered even after the fact.
But that's right. They only heard about the policy because they learned about it from the
mother Tillett and daughter Tillett is one issue. The other issue is, daughter and, who's the parent? Morris.
Yes.
Moss, Robert Moss, his daughter.
And they also don't have standing. First of all, there is absolutely no proof that Melissa Moss, who is the student, was academically disadvantaged in any way by the program. She had a higher class rank than anyone who took advantage of the release time class. And there was no academic advantages conferred on students who chose to took that class. It was not eligible for honors credit, AP credit, IB credit, all sorts of other credits that would allow them to enhance their GPAs and become more competitive. So actually, there's an academic disadvantage for a student who chooses to take release time if they're looking to maximize their GPA. The only other so-called injuries you have are the fact that the Mosses received a letter in their home from a third party, the release time provider, which they found to be offensive, and the fact that when they went to complain about this policy to the school board chose not to rescind the policy but to continue ahead. And then, of course, one incident where Ms. Moss requested to look at a student's syllabus and notes, a student who was in the class, and that student showed them to her. These are a few isolated incidents, but none of them amount to a legally cognizable injury inflicted on the Mosses by the school board.
Plus, if we look at the Zorich case, court didn't do a whole lot of analysis there. It just said that the jurisdiction is posed since the appellants here are parents of the children currently attending the school subject to the release time program. End of discussion. If we take that as being what it means, then I don't know. I mean, we've got cases afterwards, but the Zork case is the United States Supreme Court case, pretty much is on point on that. I mean, I just don't know where we go with the standing thing, and I think Judge Niemeyer is correct in terms of the differentiation of the plaintiffs here. My only question was, is that something we ought to just either assume and go straight to this issue and move on? I'm trying to move to the disposition of it.
I don't believe the court should assume standing here. If you look at what the Supreme Court said in Steele Co. long after Zorach, it said that so-called drive-by jurisdictional rulings have no precedential effect. So it's questionable to what degree Zorach is controlling on this point. Now, also in Zorach, you had a case that had gone up on the pleadings after a motion to dismiss. And so all we had were the allegations in the pleadings. And there was an allegation that most of the students left the school to attend release time, and the other students were just sort of left there without much going on. And so you still had an adverse impact upon the students' education and upon their school day, because their students, their classmates are leaving to go elsewhere, and then they're left behind, apparently without much to do. And that's the same kind of situation you had before the Second Circuit in Pierce. And so you do have some sort of adverse impact on the student's educational experience even there. Here you haven't had that. You only have, on average, 4 students out of 1,500 in a given semester choosing to go and take advantage of a release time class. So you don't have that kind of negative impact upon the student's school day. The plaintiffs here really are in the same position as those before the Fifth Circuit in Doe v. Tangipahoa Parish. There you had parents who were parents of students in the high school who wanted to challenge a school district policy, in that case prayer at school board meetings. And the Fifth Circuit found that they did not have standing because they failed to prove that they were actually present at the school board meetings where the offending prayers were said. The fact that they were parents with students in the school district was not enough to get them over the hurdle. They still needed to prove that they had actually had some sort of contact, that they had actually been injured by the religious display that they were challenging. And this is similar to what this court has done in the religious display cases, such as Sher v. Haywood County, where you have a plaintiff who had standing because there was a Ten Commandments display in the courtroom, and he had to go into that courtroom for various civic purposes and also involuntarily as a criminal defendant and view that plaque again and again. And so he actually did have direct contact. Here you simply have a group of plaintiffs who know about a policy, are offended by the fact that policy exists, and want to challenge it. And that's a very broad rule of standing to set in place, that every time a group of parents or students is upset about a school district policy, they have standing simply by value of being students in that school district to come before this court and challenge it.
Counsel, I ask a question about punishment. Now, the court, the school retains jurisdiction to deal with behavioral problems while they're at the site of the off-campus instruction, correct?
It retains some limited jurisdiction.
Yeah, for behavior problems, right? They could be, you could be, whatever the school has in terms of procedures for punishing poor behavior or misconduct, jurisdiction lies when they're in those classes as well, correct?
The school district has said that what it will do is address serious discipline violations. So, say if a student had a weapon present at a release time class, that's the kind of situation where the school district might get involved and exercise its discipline policy.
Is it just serious?
It said level 3 disciplinary violations, which
only
are the highest
three?
Level.
Only level 3?
Yes. In other situations, they might, say, speak to a student. I know that there's one incident where a student had misbehaved and they were spoken to but not receive any formal disciplinary consequences. But the school district has said that for simple classroom management sort of issues, that the release time providers need to handle that themselves. And Superintendent White's deposition talks about that in 259 and 264 of the record, goes into that one incident and how the school district views these sorts of disciplinary issues generally. And so we're talking about some very minor isolated contacts and largely hypothetical contacts because we haven't had that sort of serious disciplinary violation occur. It's not something that would rise to the level of a religious entanglement and therefore create an Establishment Clause violation.
Because you can see there could be potential problems if you were dealing with every type of infraction or misconduct, because some may arise from not complying with a religious type instruction, like, well, I'm not going to do that, for example.
You could think of a hypothetical situation where, yes, where there might be some kind of religious offense and the SCBEST, you know, wanted to transfer that student back for discipline from the public school. The public school has indicated that they are not going to handle that kind of discipline. They're only going to handle serious disciplinary infractions that would warrant them getting involved in any circumstance, like if a student were to be, you know, acting up in the school parking lot, misbehaving at a sports event, all sorts of other off-campus activities that would warrant school district intervention.
Anything else?
I'm sorry?
Anything else? I don't want to cut you off.
No, I wanted to respond briefly on the plaintiff's arguments resting on Larkin v. Grindle's Den. That really is the heart of their entanglement argument. And I want to emphasize that in Larkin, what the Supreme Court was looking at there were two traditional and I would say exclusive government functions. That is the zoning power and the power to excuse me, the power to regulate liquor licenses under the 21st Amendment. The Supreme Court called that a traditional government task. It talks about the broad powers of the states under the 21st Amendment. It says this is a power ordinarily vested in the agencies of government. That is very different from awarding course credit and a grade, something that is regularly done by both public and private actors every day. A student, as we all know, can go all the way through private education and receive a diploma that way and still go on to college. And a student may choose to have private education and then transfer into public education. And this is not something that is constitutionally problematic. This is not a traditional exclusive government power that is being delegated and handed off to a religious body. This is simply a power that is regularly exercised both by public actors and private actors. And there is no entanglement problem to simply let the status quo continue to exist. In short, the plaintiffs do not have standing because they've not been injured in any way by this policy. They've not had any direct contact with the policy. There has been no Establishment Clause violation here. The plaintiffs have conceded that there is no improper religious purpose. The policy has not advanced or endorsed religion in any way, and there has been no religious entanglement. And therefore, the decision below should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Daly.
The defendant interprets its policy to mean that it must accept all these grades. It is not a discretionary policy. That's at page 273 and 274 of the record. Does it automatically transfer, or are there certain grades that come from accredited school institutions that don't transfer? No, sir, they transfer. Everything transfers? Yes, sir. That takes the discretion out of this policy, whether it's tracking the state statute or modeling on the state statute.
Because, you know, while you were sitting down, I looked at the policy that they imitated, which was the school association policy, and Spartanburg County adopted it verbatim, and the state policy said they are implementing the state act. And they say, building on the 2002 state law designed to establish a constitutionally acceptable method of allowing release time programs for public school students in religious instruction, the legislature this year enacted the South Carolina Release Time Credit Act. Then they go on talk about it, and then they propose a policy for released time religious instruction. That's the policy that Spartanburg County School adopted. And under that, we already went through, the district will evaluate the classes on the basis of the secular criteria prior to accepting credit. And of course, those criteria are set forth in the statute, four of them. Number of hours, classroom instruction time, the syllabus, the assessment in the course, and the certified teacher.
All right, aspect. Several points. Number one, their interpretation of it, their firm interpretation of it, is it doesn't give them discretion, and the state statute does give discretion. Secondly, as to the secular evaluation, they say, we don't do it. That's page 273 in the record. They say, Oak Brook does it for us, and what Oak Brook does is a religious evaluation. And Spartanburg also has another provision to their policy, which is not written anywhere, but that is that we'll only accept grades from accredited schools. And what that means is that your religion has got to be grown up enough to be able to get some secular school, school to agree to pass it along. And there are not any Jewish schools in the county, and there are not any Wiccan schools. So this thing, as interpreted by them, has a hidden discrimination between religions in it because of this secret protocol.
What's the evidence that the school cares? The school has not indicated an interest in any religious aspect. They go out of their way in emphasizing the secular and trying to remain separate to accommodate these students. And as I understand it, the number of students taking advantage of this is quite small.
Well, it's rather large in other districts. And
well, yeah, but this is this school, they said this average of what?
I don't think it makes any difference. We're talking about an effect of a standardless delegation. Larkin says you can't have a standardless delegation under the Lemon Second.
I just don't see that in the policy. I know you read it differently, but I...
There is a delegation in there which says we only accept grades from accredited schools. That's an unwritten rule, but it's very clear.
Oh, I don't see it here, but it seems to me that would narrow it. That would increase the secular basis, because an accredited school, it goes through all kinds of other approval things, how many hours they do,
right,
whether they have certified teachers, whether they have the funding.
If you're running a little fundamentalist Baptist church out in the country and you want to get release time religious credit, you got to find a big-time accredited school that will agree to pass your grades along. And what the record shows here is that Oak Brook agreed to pass those grades along because it fit in with Oak Brook's theological disposition. They were interdenominational. They weren't Jewish. They don't have any motive to help Jewish. So we've set up a situation here that's going to have a discriminatory effect and divide one religion among another.
Okay. Anything further?
Y'all are a tough bunch. All right.
What did you say?
I said y'all are a tough bunch.
That's disrespectful to the court, sir.
Oh, no, Your Honor. It's just colloquial. I mean, this has been a tough argument.
You should refrain from...
Well, I apologize and withdraw.
I appreciate your apology, but
all right,
it's not appropriate.
Well, no offense, but...
All right. None taken, but be careful, because there's students out in the court and we don't model a type of respect. I'm talking to you and you're walking away, so you continue to model it. This is a very serious case.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
This is a court of law.
I understand.
Proper respect. There's certain levels of colloquium that's allowed, but that's not one. Walking away from the court when I'm talking to you.
I understand. I didn't quite realize you were...
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, my apologies. I've been a lawyer in this court for 43 years, and...
I understand that. And I know that. I accept your apology, but I think that your further walking off when I'm talking to you does not demonstrate your having corrected, but that's fine. I accept that.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll come down and greet counsel and then take a short recess.